I convened this series to serve the evolution of consciousness and culture by creating a deep public dialogue about how higher consciousness and spiritual practice can play a role in helping human beings to rise to meet the challenges of our current crisis. I've now held over 90 remarkable conversations on this topic with many of today's leading thought leaders and spiritual teachers. And once you've registered at beyondawakeningseries.com, they're all available for free download at beyondawakeningseries.com/blog. Today, I'm joined by Ole Vadum Dahl. We'll continue that discussion in a conversation we've titled, How Going Blind Opened My Eyes. The way this will work is that I'll introduce Ole, and we'll dialogue for about an hour. Then I'll make some announcements, and we'll spend about half an hour taking your questions, and then we'll finish up in about 90 minutes. Ole Vadum Dahl is the founder and director of ID Academy, the largest postgraduate psychotherapy academy in Denmark, and ID Academy Media, or IAM, an important Danish publisher of leading-edge integral psychological and spiritual books. He has more than 30 years of experience in psychotherapy, coaching, and spiritual and personal development, and has taught in Denmark, India, Europe, and the USA. He's pioneered several cutting-edge techniques and training modalities, most recently in integral philosophy, psychology, spirituality, and life practice. He's authored 5 best-selling books in Denmark on self-development, therapy, and coaching. But what I personally especially love about Ole is his uncanny combination of special capacities. He's got really non-ordinary intuitive awareness, plain old brilliant intelligence, deep feeling sensitivity to others, individually and in groups, and the energetic dynamics of groups. And he has an uncanny ability to communicate with deep attunement and gentleness and generosity. It's especially impressive that he combines all that with being also a very grounded guy who makes a lot happen in the practical world. In the short time I've known him, we've become good friends, and I'm with him now at his home in Denmark. So welcome, Ole. I'm so happy to have you with me today on this program.
Thank you so much, and thank you for the very nice introduction. So thank you.
Well, great. Well, we've titled this this dialogue, How Going Blind Opened My Eyes, and I think it would be appropriate for us to begin by my inviting you to tell the story of how you lost your sight when you were young and what that was like and how that, in a sense, opened your eyes.
Yeah. The first signs of bad eyesight was already when I was 5 years old. I had problems knowing where my twin sister was, and they found out I was pretty short-sighted. And also in the night, as long as I remember, I have had difficulties seeing when it's dark. So, I think everybody would just think that I had a little problems with being short-sighted and night blind. So I functioned pretty normal with eyeglasses and needing to be guided when it was dark, but otherwise I had normal eyesight. I was biking around and I was drawing and I was painting pictures and I was taking photos. I loved that. I was a very visual boy, so I enjoyed nature tremendously. Remembering the vacations with my parents down south to Austria and Italy, the mountains and everything. It was just filled me with wonder, you know. So I was very visual. And also I was one of the few things I was really good at. I was not so good at sports and other kind of practical things. But I was very good at painting and drawing, so I wanted to become an architect. I was drawing houses, lots of houses already as a young boy, drawing and painting, and I was good at it, so I got a lot of my self-confidence from that. Then I started noticing when I was about 15, 16 years old that that people got a little annoyed with me because I was not greeting them when I met them downtown anymore. And I noticed, oh, maybe I need some other glasses because it's a little blurry. But I didn't pay much attention until the principal of my school called me one day and said, Uli, you need to come to my office. I want to talk with you. And I got a little worried because I thought, what did I do? Because when the principal calls you, you might have done something wrong. So I went there, and he said to me, very friendly, he said to me, Uli, you need to go and see an eye doctor. You have serious trouble with your eyesight. And I resisted. I thought, yeah, I know, I'm short-sighted, and I just moved to a new school, so I thought maybe they don't have as much lighting as the old school. It was becoming darker. But he said, no, that's not it. You have a serious problem. Go and see your eye doctor. I did. And he got very quiet, and he said to me, you need to go to a specialist to go and see with your parents, go and see a specialist, because something is not as it should be. I went to the specialist, and she was also getting quiet, you know. And I went back home without her saying much. Then my parents came to me, and they said, Ole, actually, the eye doctor said that you should not know it, but until you have finished your school, but you're going to be blind. And my first reaction was, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, I mean, this is a little funny. Why shouldn't they tell me? I might notice until I reach the end of the year with the exams and so on. And I was right about that, because when I got to the exam period, I couldn't read anymore. And I couldn't see what I was writing myself. So my twin sister had to read out loud my study books, so I was prepared for the exams. So that was kind of it went really fast from I discovered that something was quite wrong, and until I couldn't read anymore, and it was dangerous for me to move around without a stick or a guide somehow. I think it was within a year or less that it went really down fast. So. And then I was in the middle of all this and realizing that, my ambitions about drawing and painting and taking photos, becoming an architect, maybe I had to forget that, because that would be impossible with that kind of an eyesight. And yet I still found it interesting. I was curious about this condition, and a lot started happening for me, because a lot of people got involved. I needed to learn Braille, you know, the reading the Braille, and I needed to learn how to use a stick, and also I was granted a guide dog. Even I was not old enough for that. I was about 17 at that time. So I was sent to the U.S. actually to get my first guide dog there. I was part of an exchange project. So I came over there for a month, had a great time. I still had so much eyesight that I could still enjoy some of the visual things. Even I was dangerous alone in the traffic. So a lot of things happened, I was just curious about it all. So I think it took about maybe 1.5 or 2 years until I realized this is serious. I mean, you need to you need to find out what to do instead with your life, because everything you have ever dreamed of is gone, you know, as a possibility, and your and my self-confidence was going down also, because what to identify with, you know. Usually we prefer to identify with skills we have, things we're good at, things we succeed with, and it was gone. So I started getting into an identity crisis. I was confused about what I wanted to do, and I felt kind of, I started feeling insecure about myself. I started getting kind of anxiety attacks, which was kind of not really very concrete. I didn't know what they were about. I was just getting anxious and slightly depressed. So, at that time, that we're back in the middle of the 70s, and at that time, when you lost your eyesight or you were blind, the different possibilities were not that many. I mean, so I had a musical talent too, so it was somehow decided that when I had this musical talent, I should learn how to play the church organ, because that was one of the professions for the blind at that time. Either you could become a telephonist, you know, a receptionist, you could take phones, and or you could somehow learn how to tune the piano, or you could become a church organist, you know, so organ player. But I have this music talent, so I started studying music. And when I was 19, I was sent to Copenhagen to learn a lot on the Institute for the Blind in Copenhagen, which was kind of a shock for me when I came there, because I had now lost my eyesight, and I couldn't see much anymore. Everything was just totally blurry. I couldn't read. I couldn't walk alone without my dog. And yet, I didn't consider myself blind. I couldn't identify with it. I was really not identified. And people started treating me in what I considered a very strange way, because they approached me like a handicapped young guy instead of just this normal, naughty, hippie boy I was at that time. I was approached like a helpless, handicapped guy. And I hated it so much that I started trying to hide it, my blindness. So I didn't want to use a stick, and I didn't put on the what do you call that? The harness of the dog. Yeah, with the signs of being blind. So I took that off, and then I discovered why I would have such a thing on the dog, because if you just use a normal leash on the dog, you can't feel when it stops or
right.
So I had a lot of small accidents because I just walked with my guide dog in a leash. But I hated the people stopping me and asking me questions about being blind or handicapped. And I hated all the good stories they told me about. They had a neighbor whose uncle also was blind, and he was, oh my God, he was so smart. He could even make his own food. And I felt like put into a category. I hated it. So I tried to hide it, which was pretty difficult. And when I came to the Institute for the Blind and I met all the other guys who couldn't see either, I noticed that they were very identified with being blind. The way they were talking, all they were focusing on was their handicap. And I thought, honestly, I thought, let me get out of here, and that has to be fast, because it's bad enough that I can't see. What if I get blind? That was my way of thinking about it. You know?
You mean that you not being able to see, that maybe you could deal with, but becoming identified with that as who you were, that would be like a prison.
Yes.
And that was distinct. Those two things were obviously distinct to you right away.
Right away.
Mm.
And I never managed so far to become blind. I just can't see, as I used to say. I think it's a couple of years ago, I was at a conference with the Dalai Lama, by the way, and in the lunch break, I was sitting at a table, and at the table next to me, a couple of people were talking about that a woman, she had been joining some courses and some trainings, and then the guy asked, was it with this blind guy? And I didn't even realize that it was me they were talking about. Because when people talk about blind people, I have to remember that I'm included in that category. So, but I think that has helped me a lot. I've learned a lot from it. We can go into that. And I think the most important thing for me about not having become blind, but just not being able to see, is that because I don't identify with my limitations, I have done things I would not do otherwise. And it's not just about being blind or being limited in some other ways. My experience was from that on, time on, that if you identify with your limitations, if you make it who you are, then you're in trouble. I mean, then you will start living a limited life.
Mm.
So that has been the foundation for everything I've been doing, basically, since then.
Mm-hmm.
And also the anxiety attacks, I discovered that it was because of loss of identity that I started becoming anxious. Even I didn't identify with being blind. I didn't have much else to identify with. All what I used to do was somehow gone, and I needed to find a new identity as whoever I was. So it threw me into a crisis. And when I was about 20 years old, I was so much in pain and so much in anxiety and so depressed that I contacted my physician, my doctor, and said, I need something for this. I mean, I need some pills or something to take away my anxiety, and I couldn't sleep at night. I was afraid of dying. I lived at the fifth floor. I was afraid that the house would break down, which is quite interesting, seen from a Jungian perspective. The house of the self is collapsing, right? Which is, that my house of the self was collapsing. So.
Mm.
But I had a pretty smart young female doctor, and she said, no, Ulu, you're not going to have medicine. You're going to have psychotherapy. So I started. She was being trained as a psychotherapist, and she invited me to come twice a week even to have psychotherapy with her. And that was a new world for me. That was so fantastic. And you know, the old Gestalt pioneer Fritz Perls, he once said that the best sign that the patient is getting better is that he or she wants to become a psychotherapist, him or herself. So I was getting better. I wanted to become a psychotherapist. I thought that if I could learn how to ask such questions and to give such beautiful feedback and to listen so carefully and empathetically, if that was a skill to be learned, I wanted to learn that. I wanted to do that with others. I wanted to help others who were in pain like me. So that was the beginning of it all. And that, again, opened up to curiosity for other things. I started going to everything I could, you know, men's groups. It was about that time of history where We had women's groups and men's groups, and I was in the university studying music at that time, and
right.
kind of progressive green orientation, you know. And one of my study mates said, "Oh, Ole, you should learn how to meditate." So, and at that time, it was transcendental meditation, the only thing you could practice, basically. So I went there and got my mantra and experienced a new sense of being, which I hadn't been in contact with before. That was kind of a revelation for me, both the deep level of relaxation, but also this sense of being me in a very different way. It was not this tense guy, Ole, who was full of inferiority and insecurity and lack of self-confidence, and who was so tight around other people that my body would hurt after a couple of hours. I suddenly felt kind of a deep relaxation for the first time, for many years actually, and I felt this sense of being, something deeper me, you know. So whatever happened, I got in touch with something new. A new level of myself for the first time.
And that began to affect the way you were able to be when you were in these groups and psychotherapeutic kinds of situations too,
yes.
I guess.
Yes, absolutely. And I very early I became aware how much the sense of identity, the feeling good about myself, how important that was for where I would restrict myself and where I would go for my dreams. And I became very quickly aware of the importance of identity. That's also why today I call my system ID therapy and ID life coaching and ID mindfulness and so on, because also in my therapeutic career I've seen that I've learned a lesson about what identification means for your whole life and for your development and for your sense of well-being.
Mm.
It's just so basic for anything, for your success in life, for your relationships, for your courage in a way, for everything. So and the longer I was experimenting with meditation and self-help groups and psychotherapy and different kinds of psychotherapy, the clearer it became for me that my sense of identity was developing. My sense of self-confidence was growing, and my sense of self-worth was growing, and that was all good. You know, my self-respect was growing, but there was something which was kind of independent of self-confidence and self-worth. There was a deeper sense of identity, a beingness, which was kind of behind it all, you know, and I realized that self-confidence, which is very much associated to what you're good at and what you succeed with, I mean, that's kind of fragile. You can lose that.
Mm-hmm.
If you lose your skill, like I had lost my ability to draw and paint and take good photos and so. I mean, any skill you can lose. So you can, anytime, you can lose your self-confidence.
Mm.
So, and self-worth, in a way, is very often dependent on that you feel that you're important for someone else, you make a difference, and so on. And that's a little more stable or a little more solid, but still you can lose it because you can lose people. You will lose people, and you might get kind of into conflicts with people. You might lose their their appreciation and so on. So it's also fragile in a way, and I realized that that's not truly who I am. There's something deeper, which has always been me and which will always remain me, something independent of what I do, where I'm born, whether I'm Danish or German or American, whether I'm young or old, or whether I'm successful or not successful, whether I have a particular intelligence or not. That there's a level of identity or of being me which is totally independent of that, and therefore which is the most stable, the most permanent kind of identity you can have, in a way, abiding in your in a deeper sense of being without any imaginations about yourself or any reflections upon yourself or any self-image or anything like that.
And this, you've gotten into describing this very beautifully and very organically as a kind of progression of the story of your, of the openings that took place after going blind and then beginning to open up your consciousness beyond the identities you didn't want to take on.
Yes.
And yet I'm sure there were things going on at the same time in your practical life. Like, in some sense, we are shifting our focus, I think, in a beautiful way from the outer story of the facts of your life to the inner exploration of the opening of your, maybe a different kind of opening your eyes, like in the title of our dialogue.
Yes.
And I'm curious, this was happening even while you were in your psychotherapy training in the very early years of beginning to open into who you
yes
are now.
Yes.
So even earlier than meeting your teacher and opening into everything there, this recognition that there was something more essential began to dawn. Is that
that's
am I
correct.
Following?
Yes, yeah. That's correct. I had my first glimpses of who I truly am in very early, actually. I think I was in 22 or something, 21, 22, when I started having these experiences. And at the same time, I would still have some anxiety, you know, at times, and I would still have some suffering going on and some tension going on, and I would still fall into identifying with not being very successful or being insecure, and also it in a way it's a sensitive age to lose your eyesight, because it's also the time where meeting girlfriends and starting to have a love relationships become really important. And I didn't really feel much like Brad Pitt or anything like that.
Yeah.
You know, I would
didn't do
I
much
would,
for your sex appeal.
Yeah, exactly. I would have loved to take my arm around her waist and saying, okay, honey, let me take you home, you know. But it was more like I had to take her arm and said, would you guide me home? So, and I was very fond of girls and young women as early as I can remember, actually. So my self-confidence around that was not so good either. So I had my challenges. Even I didn't have problems meeting women or attracting women for some reason, but that didn't make a difference, because my own feeling of being attractive was not so good. I mean, I was more internally referenced when it came to whether I was attractive or not. So didn't matter if 20 women thought I was a nice guy or attractive. I didn't feel like that myself. So I had to work on that myself. So I still had a lot of themes to deal with, you know, and and still people were kind of in the normal world, kind of people were relating to me as this handicapped guy, and I hated it still. But in the self-help movement, in these circles, in this community of people being interested in meditation and other things, people related to me in a different way. I mean, they were more relating to my being. And actually, I remember when I came to Pune in India, where I met my teacher in 81.
Bhagavan Rajneesh.
Yes, that was Bhagavan Rajneesh. And when I came to the ashram in 81, I traveled down there. It was so strange for me, because I still had, in spite I had been working for some years, I had started training as a psychotherapist, and yet I still felt kind of insecure and vulnerable and so on. And I came down there, and it was as if people didn't relate to my neurosis, you could say. They didn't relate to my insecurity. They didn't relate to my lack of eyesight at all. They related to something else. They saw something, a light in me, or they related to something which was becoming visible to myself. But I was still amazed that these guys were kind of relating to something deeper. I felt a different kind of connection with them.
Right.
And that was another revelation that, oh, maybe relationships can be something else when you relate from your being instead of relating from what you're good at or what kind of a status you have or what you can do and what you cannot do.
Mm-hmm.
So my whole life from I lost my eyesight was kind of experience after experience after experience of what different kinds of identity meant for my well-being, for my life altogether.
And what I notice about you, full disclosure, everyone, Ole and I have just spent the weekend together. I was facilitating a workshop here, and he joined me, and I've had the opportunity to have private conversations and to watch him in some other situations and groups. And as you might be getting a little bit of a feeling for, he's remarkably awake and sensitive to the essential level of the being of other people, and also to the subtle energetic dynamics in others and in groups. And I think some of that must have already begun to unfold as people were responding to you in this different way in Pune. And maybe something, I'd really be interested to hear you describe in as fresh and immediate, not abstract, but just kind of in the innocent way that you've been talking about these other aspects of your experience, just how you began to notice these subtler levels of these dynamics, because you're a remarkable facilitator and teacher. And,
thank you.
And it's because it's as if you can see, you know, you may be blind in the normal visual sense, but you have extraordinarily keen sensitivity in this other sense, and it allows you to really gently resonate with people and with groups, and to speak in a way that is profoundly attuned, and somehow that opened up also. And if I could, you know, lure you into describing the subtleties of just how, you know, what you began to pay attention to and how that affected you and where that came from in your experience. I think that would be really helpful.
Yeah. I think the first times I started realizing something about a special sensitivity was when I actually, when I couldn't see people anymore, I realized I was not distracted by the way they looked, the faces they took on, or the facade in a way, and I started feeling what's going on. For instance, when people related to me and they were kind of polite or nice or something like that, I got two messages, which was kind of disturbing for me and confusing for me, because one thing was often what people said mm-hmm. and the way they said it, and another thing was the feeling I got, and I didn't dare trusting it in the beginning. And also when I watched other people talk together, you know, one thing was what I could hear them say. Another thing was that I suddenly could feel the emotions in people, and I could feel kind of the emotional, for instance, the conflicts between people, which was not pronounced. I felt it in myself. I got this. For me, it was also a little bit uncanny because I didn't know what to do with it. So what do you do when you get two? You have two realities at the same time. One is what people are saying to each other or how they're acting towards me. Another thing is what I felt very strongly, you know. So I started picking up people's emotions and sometimes even their thoughts, you know. I found it actually a little bit uncanny because suddenly information popped into my head. And so it was like because I had been blindfolded involuntarily in a way, I started sensing with some other channels. It was like my personal satellite disc was being installed, and I started picking up things, and so it was very disturbing, and I think it was just when I started being trained as a psychotherapist and that I started having my intuitions, we could call it, confirmed. I started realizing this is a good tool, you know, because when I can't see the body language of people or their body posture, or I mean, as long as people were just talking, I could listen to some of their tonality and the way they were talking and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But often people were quiet, you know, so people were not saying anything because they were considering something or they were feeling a lot and not really expressing it with words.
Mm-hmm.
So I would be a little bit, actually then I would be a little bit handicapped in those situations. But I realized that I was still getting information, even people stopped talking. So I developed in a way fine-tuned my ability to sense people's emotions and also their mental patterns to a certain degree. And that has been a continuous process since I was in the middle of my 20s, I think, and now I'm 58. So I've been training that a lot. Involuntarily, I've been training it a lot because I've been working with thousands of people over the years. So, and then when I started, when I started meditating a lot, and when I started getting more experiences of my own consciousness, different states of consciousness, and I began to have particular openings into other realms of being, then it was like that opened up to also being able to sense more subtle energies, not only the emotions or the mental patterns of people. Then I started being able to somehow to sense the shifts of people's energy. Actually, I see it. You know, I don't see it with my physical eyes, but my mind or my consciousness is somehow translating it, because I'm still a very visual person without being able to see. So I start seeing kind of you could call it aura, or you could call it energy around people and in people. So I have a quite clear view of people, and I think like a lot of other people might be able to see small changes in the body language, in the facial expressions, or in the eyes and so on. I just see it in another way. I usually say that I'm cheating. I'm seeing it in different ways. So, and that's what makes me able to work the way I do.
Right.
And I feel like saying that this is nothing particular for me in a way. I think if anybody who's just a little sensitive and who's working with themselves, if they were blindfolded for just a period of time, they would start recognizing the same things as I do. So I think it's just a matter of me not being distracted by my vision, that I pay attention to other things.
Well, I think that's probably really a beautiful and generous and valuable thing for us to pay attention to, but I don't want us to be misleading anyone. And, you know, I've talked with you a lot. You're also really brilliantly observant and able to operate, you know, to think multidimensionally in a way that isn't so common. So you brought that awareness and also a certain basic, I don't know, sweetness and gentleness that is, you know, there's a genuine goodwill that you're bringing to people that is also not, you know, whatever ways in which you might have been neurotic, you hadn't lost touch with something, and all of that conspired to help you be able to show up with people in a way that they've, of course, appreciated.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. I don't know what to say about that.
but let's pick up on where you were going, just not to focus then on that compliment so much, but to say, so when I close my eyes and I notice subtle shifts in what I feel,
yes,
and I tune into that,
yes,
I can notice not only the incongruities, but all kinds of subtleties.
Yes.
And if I'm able to pay attention to that, and since I can see also and hear, I have multiple channels, perhaps combining them would be even the highest best,
yes,
option.
Yeah.
And yet there's a stretching of one's capacity to be with all of that and to not let the visual or any sense overwhelm something very subtle and silent and deep that you especially tuned into. And the more you can say about how you notice that, and you've said in a previous conversation to me that it's almost as though you can see it visually.
Yes.
What more can you tell us about that?
Are you asking about my way of perceiving other people, or are you...
Yeah.
Yeah. I think one of the things I've noticed as I've been going deeper into my own being is that actually the more I somehow lean outwards towards people and try to figure them out by analyzing them or to paying a lot of attention outwards, the more they keep being separate from me, you know, and the more there's a risk of interpretation and misunderstanding, and the more I lean into my own being, the deeper I go into my being, the more I discover that the we space between us, the more open the connection is becoming, the more connected I feel with other people, and the more empathy I feel for them. So it's a kind of a paradox that the more I move inwards, the more I actually embrace other people, the more I feel connected with them. And if they, and I call this an invitation, you know, that, so if I am willing to be in a deep contact with my own being, as I am aware of another person in front of me, it's like I'm inviting them into being with me, you know. And if they accept my invitation, and if they also somehow remember themselves in the contact with me, that there can be a profound sense of we, of a deep, really nourishing, empathetic contact. I mean, and that my experience is that that is in itself transformative. That if we can meet on a being level, if we're not so focused on the surface, if we meet people from inside and out instead of from outside and in, if we start abiding in our own being and we open ourselves to others from that place, we can have a much deeper, much more profound contact. And not only that, if we're willing to meet each other that way, we'll transform, we'll go deeper. My invitation, the more I lean into me, the more I open the possibility for the other one to do the same. So there'll be more of us together and individually, the more we both stay in touch with our own being and be aware of each other, open to each other, being open in the contact. So, and I think that's the basis of my work today. That I actually teach without talking about it. I teach people something about who they are by paradoxically just being myself or remembering myself in the contact with other people. It's like it's opening a space for deepening, or also for the other person.
Well, maybe this is, I realize that during this first hour I shouldn't, I'm loving what we're doing, but you've developed an off, you know, you've written 5 books, I was just kind of feeling like I wanted to ask you a little bit more about the who am I process that you teach. And
yes,
and you know, you've founded 2 schools and are currently heading up the largest psychotherapeutic training program in Denmark, and also train a lot of life coaches and mindfulness coaches and other, you know, many other programs in a publishing house. I mean, you're an amazingly productive and successful guy, and to some degree that is, you know, it's about some additional skills, not just the sensitivity in the moment to the field and the people, but I just want to say this sensitivity helped grow you from whatever failures of self-confidence might have held you back before to a place where you're able to rest in a very creative and powerful place that's generated a lot. And I think what might be most interesting for people to hear about, you know, in addition to the line of discussion that we've been following, might be some of the identification and disidentification processes that you lead people in, and if there's even one that we might go through rather quickly in the next, 10 minutes or so, I'd be grateful. I think it would help us really get to know how you work and why that's touched people so deeply, and create all of what you've generated.
Yeah. I hope I'll be answering what you actually asked me. what I have found over the years is that one of the greatest challenges for people in their life, one of the reasons why we continuously get stuck in these same old themes, is that we are somehow identified with particular sides or parts of our personality, that we, in a way, we are deeply embedded in being pleasing or over-responsible or perfectionistic or self-critical any kind of, if we look at our personality and we see what we do in just one day, we'll see that we're not just one person, we're a lot of different people in a way. We are taking on different roles, different aspects of our personality is taking over. No one is voluntarily being so perfectionistic that they're suffering about it or getting depressed. Or no one is voluntarily just choosing to criticize themselves so they feel really shitty about themselves. So we're somehow taken by different aspects of our personality. And when I look at my own life and the lives of my clients over the years, I can see that the places where we don't change, that's because we haven't discovered that we're identified with a particular side of ourselves. We keep being victims in a lot of situations because we're so embedded in it, we don't even discover it. It's a very difficult type of unconsciousness. So the basis for all my my trainings, and the therapy and the coaching I've been doing is to help people discover what they are identified with, what they are embedded in, without knowing it, actually. Mm. And helping them getting out of that, to in the first place, to discover at all, you know, that you are identified, that you are embedded in a certain, with a certain aspect of yourself. So you think that's who you are.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a flaw, because that's not who you are. So the basis of my whatever I've been doing has been to help people discover what they are not,
mm-hmm.
and in the disidentification, then helping them do that in the disidentification, then they. I mean, it's like, I don't know if you know Michelangelo, the famous Italian artist. Once he was asked about how he would be able to create these wonderful statues out of this raw marble or whatever, raw stone. And he said, this is simple. I mean, the statue is already there. The sculpture is already there. I just have to take the unnecessary parts away. I just need to take away what's around the sculpture. Yeah.
I've heard that.
Yeah.
It seems almost like a joke, but you're listening to that at a deeper level. That...
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly what I'm doing with my coaching and therapy and my mentoring, that is somehow taking away what is covering up the diamond or the natural beauty or the actual person which is underneath, you know. Mm-hmm. And what I'm helping them to remove is their embeddedness or their identification. All they think they are, which they are not. And then there's nothing to replace. There's nothing. You don't need to build any self-confidence. You don't need to build any self-worth, because it's irrelevant. If you get in touch with the beauty, the art piece underneath the diamond, then it's already there, you know.
I'm curious, you know, in many different spiritual teachings and in my own experience, of course, I've awakened to a deeper level of being that isn't dependent. And yet it has been the report of pretty much everyone I've ever met, and it's even my own experience, that the local weather of people's respect or disrespect or approval or disapproval doesn't cease to register, and it has its sort of effect at a certain level of being.
Yes.
There's a deeper level that is, I mean, there's a radical level in which I simply am consciousness itself.
Yes.
And then there's a level that's more intermediate, maybe more like what you mean when you say essence, that is causal and subtle, where I'm in touch with something with my embodiedness, but it's not as associated with my my personality and my moment to moment
right
rising and falling of good and bad experience.
Right.
And yet it's kind of just like, you know, the fact that I'm my loving nature or my the essential goodness of my being or something.
Yes,
that,
yes.
I'm in touch with something more essential. And I suspect you're talking maybe about that as well as the radical level in which I'm simply the witness, consciousness
yes.
itself.
It's kind of a progression. I mean, a slow progression. In the beginning, you start getting in touch with maybe some deeper sense of being, which is still very personal. It's your special flavor of, you know, you can also see when I have three children, and when they were born, I mean, they didn't have any personality yet. They didn't have any kind of history or skills they could identify with. And they were so different. There was such a different atmosphere around them, such a, you know, with one of them, it was kind of very clear and alert and awake, and another one, a sweetness, you know, and a softness, and the third one, something else. So it's like, I think when that's one of the first levels we get to when we get behind all the self-contraction and all the self-images and so on, is something quite personal. It's our special, it's like a spiritual personality in a way, which is not based on any achievements or anything. It's like a very personal nature of specific qualities. As you mentioned, it could be goodness or joy or softness or humor or power or aliveness or
a certain kind of creativity or
yes.
humor. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And I think that's the subtle level. I think you would call this the soul level.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
I was going to comment, this is exactly what I've been delving yeah. into more and more deeply myself.
Yeah. So if we just take it in kind of a not so detailed way, I think we go from personality to soul, you know, where you start getting in touch with your basic goodness or peace or stillness or creativity or humor or whatever it is. So you get in touch with, it's being, but it's being with a particular quality. It's not a self-understanding or a self-reflection. It's actually a sense of being, but it has some subtle qualities to it, which make people feel that they're somehow more themselves, because there's an unconscious or half-conscious recognition of, this is really me, you know, this sensitivity I feel here, which was never seen or accepted by my parents. This is really me. I can recognize this has always been with me. You know,
and that isn't quite an identification in the same sense.
No. At least it's a very subtle kind of, because it's still a beingness, but with particular qualities. You know, and I think that's very important not to bypass that, to get in touch with your individual soul qualities, you know, instead of trying to become impersonally enlightened, because I think you're missing something very, very profound and something very important. If you don't integrate that level of yourself,
mm-hmm.
And I think for most people that is what they naturally get to when they start disidentifying with all their personality sides, you know, like the.
I do think that it can go quite far, though, and it doesn't always go all the way that it can. So there's really a great opportunity there.
Yes.
Yeah.
For me, it seems like infinite. It's infinite to explore, also on the subtle level, also on this sensual quality level. I think if you're aware, if you're attentive to this level of yourself, I mean, it's infinite. You can go on and go on discovering new, beautiful facets of being, of your own being. So,
well, this is such a rich moment, but we are a little late in making some announcements. So I want to give everybody a chance to ask questions. So if you're listening on your computer, there's a window. You can type a question in. And if you've called in by phone, you can press *2 to raise your hand. And I'll make a few announcements, and then we'll see if we have some questions. Otherwise, I'll just return to this line of conversation with you, Owen.
Great.
First, I want to make sure that people know how to find out more about your work, Ola. The website in English, you know, there are quite a few Danish websites, but for English speakers, what's the website they should go to?
Actually, I have two websites in English. One is idacademy.org, O-R-G. So it's idacademy.org.
Is that run together, or is there a hyphen?
Yeah,
in the middle?
No, it's just run together. It's
okay.
All in one.
idacademy.org.
Yeah, so that's one. And the other one, which is still under construction, because I have mostly been working here in Denmark in Danish language, but there's still a website which will evolve over the next month, and that is my last name's VADUMDAHL.com, VADUMDAHL.com.
Okay. Oh, is it pronounced Vadum instead of Vadum?
In Danish, it's Vadum, VADUMDAHL.
Okay.
It's kind of flat A's.
VADUMDAHL.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Great. So if you're interested to connect with him, can they sign up for a mailing list there?
I suppose so. My webmaster should have. Otherwise, soon we'll have a mailing list. If it's not already there.
Great.
And
well, there's certainly one at ID Academy.
And also, you're very welcome to go to my international Facebook site, which is also just facebook.com/ VADUMDAHL, VADUMDAHL. So that's a good place to stay connected and also write me if you feel like. So
wonderful.
Yes.
Well, I also want those of you on the line to know about some of my own offerings. I just had a wonderful weekend with Ola facilitating on integral life practice and integral soul work. Because as my inner life has deepened, I've been listening not only to the universal divine source of love and goodness and sacredness and silence, you know, the mystery that's beyond description, but I've also been learning to trust and listen at new depths to this essential level that we've just been talking about, my own soul. And I think there's a different kind of mystical practice that involves, and I've been focusing on it. I'm calling it integral soul work. And early this year, I decided to share that work with a couple of small circles of students. And if you're interested to know more about what I'm doing there, you can go to integralsoulwork.com and sign up for a free download of the talk with which I introduced those groups, integralsoulwork.com. And I will be doing some facilitation of additional workshops this coming weekend. I'll be teaching in Switzerland. I'll be teaching in Mexico and Guatemala in November and December. And you can find out more details about those events and all my other work by going to terrypatton.com. And you can sign up for my mailing list there. And if you click events, you'll find out more details and see a link to the registration page. Now let's take a look at the questions. Remember, pressing star 2 raises your hand, and typing in a question opens up. So let's see what we have here, if people have asked some new questions. Well, we've got a couple of new questions that have just arrived. First, Elizabeth in Arcata, California, says, "These beautiful words, thank you. As one who lost my left brain less than 2 years after getting my master's in social work just 5 years ago, bringing your title, Going Blind, opening my eyes to my own, bringing conscious understanding out of the mind. Essentially, this life event requiring our social acceptance in the synchronicity of our world, accepting our alternative ways of vibrational healing that heightened with my near death." It's not really a question, just words of deep appreciation.
Yeah, beautiful.
Here's a question that is more of a question. This is from here in Denmark, I think. This is from Vidi Brorsen in Disregard.
Mm-hmm.
Hello, Ola. What influence did Osho have on your ways of exploring the unknown, and in what ways was his influence more being a way of postponement of enlightenment?
The last part I didn't get.
What influence did Osho have on your way of exploring the unknown? And then, in what way was his influence more being a way of postponing of enlightenment?
Okay. I think meeting a spiritual teacher of that kind of capacity, which he actually had. In my case, as with so many other people, it made a deep impact. I noticed already when I listened to him, to his talks, you know, which were recorded in the 70s, where he was still really, really beautiful in his expression. I started noticing because I had started meditating and I had started getting experiences of being, that there was something in between the words, actually, which deepened my own sense of being, that he somehow, the peace from which he was talking and the stillness from which he was talking, almost channeling his words out, was resonating deeply with me. So there was something in his voice, there was something in his timing, particularly the breaks between the words, which deepened my experience of being. And I also had a couple of very personal encounters with him, where he was kind of surprising me deeply, where he was a very, very intense guy. I mean, there's been a lot of controversy around him, I know that, but he was a very, very impressive guy. I mean, even I lost my eyesight, I still had a sense of light and dark. I still have. And for ages, I thought every time he went into the room, I thought they were turning on the spotlights. Because the intensity of the light in the room became very, very intense, you know. And it took, I think it took quite a few years until I discovered that in most of the occasions there had been no spotlights. So just the presence of this guy made a strong impact on my being, which somehow was translated into light. So I think he, in different occasions, he somehow blew my mind in the best sense and opened up to deeper levels of being. And then to answer the second part of the question, which is presupposing that it could postpone enlightenment to have a guru or a teacher, as far as I interpret the question, at least, I think that might be true. That if you relate to a guru or a teacher in a childish way, and if you make him or her your positive parent, if you start giving your own authority to a teacher, if you make it an up down relationship with, I mean, that will much likely postpone your own enlightenment.
Mm.
If a teacher is your friend, if there's a mutual respect and kind of a humility or a kind of a reverence to the teacher, a respect for what the teacher can offer, using the teacher as a mirror, in a way, to discover your own divinity or your own deeper being, then a teacher is not going to postpone anything. Then the teacher will become a catalytic agent for your own deeper being. But if you make the teacher an authority, if you make him your new daddy, your positive daddy, then you start doing all kinds of trips, which I think most disciples or students of spiritual people know. They start doing this transference thing where he doesn't see me enough, or I'm not special enough, or if you start doing competition with your siblings, your spiritual siblings, because they get more attention, or they might be in the inner circle and you're not yet, or blah, blah, blah. That's then rather do some therapy. Yeah. So.
Well, thank you. That was great. We have a couple other questions, including a live question from someone on a cell phone from Southern California, from Anaheim. Hi, you're on live. Please introduce yourself.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi. My question is about what you said about children and the differences that they have when they are born, and differences in their personalities. And I was wondering how much of this has to do with their 9 months of environment in the womb, in your opinion?
I don't think these essential qualities has anything to do with the environment in the womb. I think some of the existential themes we can experience in life, our trouble, our challenges in life, can be somehow can have their source in some of what we have experienced in the womb. Stanislav Grof has been writing a lot about that and doing a lot of experience. Spiritual stuff around that, and I have a deep appreciation and respect for that kind of research he's been doing. But I think that the essential qualities itself, your basic goodness, your basic stillness, or whatever you come with into life, I think that cannot be damaged in a way, and that's not my belief is, at least, that that's not something you develop through pregnancy. I think that's something you come with. I mean, in my perspective of the world, it's something we somehow earn in different lifetimes. I mean, so as you can tell, in my world, reincarnation is a real thing. I think what I might develop or evolve or what I might crystallize of my own being during my life, I think I have it handy next time. So I think we evolve, but I think we earn these kind of qualities during our spiritual development and through our existential choices, and sometimes through our losses. For instance, I have noticed from my own life that by being in pain, having lost, through my grief, if I have been accepting deeply the grief, if I'm with no resistance, I've been embracing the sorrow, and then I develop a deeper level of empathy. And I think that will stay with me as an essential quality. It has been all the time as a potential, but I think it's crystallizing, it's integrating with life experience. So I don't think it's so much something happening unconsciously in the womb or in early childhood, maybe more there, though, but I think it's something you earn through life. That's just my experience or my view on it. So.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. We have another question from James Kohler. Hi, James. He had asked a question earlier that I didn't see that I think is really interesting, and it kind of follows on to the very example that you gave, which is about grief.
Yeah.
I think he was thinking more about your loss of your eyesight, and he asks, how important was it for you to engage yourself on a psychological level in an intentional grieving process, recognizing and accepting your limitations as a portal to go beyond them?
I think this is a great question. Thank you, James. My grief process has been very much delayed. I didn't feel grief about losing my eyesight.
Mm.
I felt in the beginning, as I told, I felt curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
Then I started feeling kind of helplessness, you know, because it's damn impractical not to see. So I felt frustration about people relating to me in that way. But I didn't feel grief. I didn't feel sorrow about it. That came much later. To be very honest, I think it came when I became a father myself. And I was 38 when I got my first child, my daughter, who's now 20. For some strange reason, I think the many situations where I realize that I'm not able to do the things I could normally do with my child because I can't see.
Hmm.
That brought up the sadness. And then more than 20 years it took until I started grieving about it. I started feeling it as a loss because now it was suddenly important. I had a very good reason to be sad about that a person I love deeply, my child, that I couldn't do the things with her, all the things at least with her that I would like to. And the funny thing is that then some years passed, 15 more years passed, you know, and I got my my first son, who is now 4 and a half, and the process repeated You know, it was kind of very surprising for myself that I felt a deep sorrow, a deep sadness, a grieving process again about realizing. Then it was suddenly a loss, because it was related to a very, very dear person, you know, where I would have loved to be more practical and to be able to do some things with, with my children. Mm. So it has. I've often thought about it. This is strange that the grieving has been so delayed in a way.
Mm.
Maybe because in the first years it was more kind of frustration about my situation and loss of identity. So the anxiety took up all the psychological space. And,
right.
And later it became kind of, it was helping me to develop certain skills and certain capabilities, as we've been talking about.
I wonder if there's an analogy, something about the process that you did describe that is a bit analogous to grieving, in that you talked about the frustration and the neurosis and then discovering, oh, well, there's a way that I can relate and this is inspiring to me and, oh, I am sensitive here and, wait a second, I'm a deeper dimension of myself, these more essential qualities. And is that a reconciling yourself with, like, there is still a coming to terms with what at first seemed like a diminishment of yourself, or at least of your function?
Yes. I'm not quite sure about your question, Terry. Where you want to go?
Well, I'm just, you know, isn't there something about landing in our divine nature and our essential nature, and in a way, the kind of happiness that is really possible in a born and dying, you know, human body mind, that has within it an element of allowing or surrendering and discovering something very sweet and beautiful, but also giving up a kind of imagined, I don't know, fulfillment or immortality, or I don't know. So there is a sort of grieving into the reality of our human possibilities.
I think, personally, I don't think I've experienced it like that. What I can recognize, though, is that sometimes when I have been looking back at all the time I have spent being restricted, you know, in the freedom, when I open into deeper levels of myself, when I get in touch with this more permanent freedom and happiness and being, sometimes I have felt kind of a sadness about all the years, in a way, I have lost being so contracted, being so restricted, being so wrong about who I was and was not. So this kind of sadness, I think I felt like anyone else, but I don't think that has anything to do with the loss of my eyesight.
No, right. Yeah. I empathize with that.
yeah. So that's more, I think that the sadness has more been being so full of love for my children, you know, and really wanting to give them everything, all I can, and feeling restricted in that, and knowing, by being very realistic, that is because of my eyesight. You know, that's my. With my children, I have not been able to run away from the fact that I can't see. That has been very confrontive. So in these occasions with my three children, I have had phases where I had to go through kind of a grieving process or a sadness or experiencing it as a loss.
Right. You know, although we're here at the end of our time, is there anything you want to say here at the end as a conclusion? I just want to give you a chance because you've shared in such a deep and beautiful way. And, you know, perhaps if you'd like to land it in some way, I want to give you a chance to do that.
I think maybe the most important thing is to if I look back at my life, you know, I often say that, and if I look at all the obstacles I've had and all the situations where I've continuously fallen back into old patterns of which has caused me a lot of suffering and pain, I think it has been very good to remember that every time I've experienced that, every time I've fallen into that, it's because I've had a false idea about who I was. And I think I've managed to remember that every time I suffer, every time I feel pain, it's because I have somehow lost the contact with who I truly am. And then I've used it, you know, to get back home. I've used it to find ways of disidentifying with all which I'm not, and used it to somehow as an opportunity somehow to start welcoming the problems, start welcoming the pain, because it's an opportunity to get home, you know, to get into who you truly are, if you use the opportunity, instead of feeling kind of stigmatized by your pain or your the problems you seem not to be able to solve. So instead of that, every time you meet an obstacle, every time you feel pain, to remember, this is an opportunity, you know, because I'm right now I'm embedded in the victim, or I am embedded in the over responsible person. I'm embedded in the self critic or in the whatever. So, and remembering that every time I have a reaction, a negative reaction, I'm embedded in something. I'm identified with something. And I think the reason why so much has happened in my life, and my life has unfolded in ways which a lot of people find very successful, and is because I've had this focus. I have not put up with just being my neurosis or just being embedded in my pain. So I think people could, if they remember every time they hurt, basically, or let's say at least most of the time we hurt. You know, sometimes you hurt because you lose people who are important for you, and that's a legitimate kind of pain, of course. But most of the time we hurt, we get anxious. It's because we're embedded. We think we're something else when we are. We are in a trance. So wake up from the trance. Use your pain as an opportunity. Disidentify from it. Get some help to disidentify. And use it as one of life's many opportunities to find out who you truly are.
Beautiful. Well, thank you, Ole. I want to tell you what's coming up and my next couple of interviews in a moment. And first, if you value what you're receiving here, please support our work by letting others know about it. They can register for this series at beyondawakeningseries.com. And if you're interested in learning more about Ole Vedum Dahl, please visit Facebook, /Vedum Dahl, and idacademy.dk, or org.
Org.
Dot org.
Yeah.
ideacademy.org and vedumdahl.com. You're also invited to go to terrypatton.com to sign up for my mailing list and newsletter, find out about my upcoming teaching events, and you can also download a free 75-minute teleseminar at integralsoulwork.com. And on October 5th, I'll be interviewing Dr. Tom Steininger on My Guru Experiment, a really fascinating conversation about his experiment as a student of Andrew Cohen, and a reflection that I think will be illuminating for many people. He's an important leader in Germany of many consciousness activities and evolutionary activities. And then I'm going to be interviewing the remarkable Andrew Harvey on October 19th. Thank you so much for joining Ola and me today. Goodbye, everybody, and thank you for joining us.